Good morning, everybody. It's nice to be with you, and I hope you're enjoying your Memorial Day weekend, the first half of it, at least. Obviously, this weekend marks a special and important time of remembrance and honor for our servicemen and women who have given their lives in their service. That's an important and weighty thing. Something that I feel is like just slightly awkward is that somewhere along the way, Memorial Day weekend has also become the unofficial marker for summer. So I'm not sure exactly how those two things go together, but let the barbecues begin, right? That barbecues and other fun in the longer light of day and the warmer evenings, along with vacations, they all start to pick up speed right around now. And then for us here in the church, we're still celebrating Easter. Does that strike you as a little bit odd? It is a little bit odd. Easter Sunday was 5 weeks ago now, and in the Silicon Valley culture that is like, let's keep it moving right on to the next thing, you could sort of wonder, like, what are we still doing in Easter? Well, I'd like to tell you that I do believe it was the wisdom of the early church mothers and fathers to recognize that the significance of Jesus' resurrection and its implications for our lives is so vast that we need to take our time with it. We need not just a day of celebration, but we need a season, Eastertide, of kneading this reality into our lives each and every year. So that's the prolonged season of Eastertide that we're in now. And at the River, we've been talking about the implications of the resurrection this year through the lens of the New Testament book of Philippians. So Philippians is a letter written by the Apostle Paul. And broad strokes, Paul is in this letter urging his readers to a different way of seeing the world. And particularly a different way of seeing the difficult circumstances that come at us in this world, along with a different way of living that is made possible because of the life, death, and present power of the resurrection of Jesus. One of the striking ways that Paul paints this vision for a different way of seeing things and a different way of being in the world comes right in the center of the book of Philippians, and it's a piece that we've been coming back to again and again. It's sort of our theme verse for this series. Paul says to the Philippians, "Do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may be blameless and pure, children of God without fault, in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky as you hold firmly to the word of life." And that's a vivid image, sort of a poetic way of talking, right? You can shine like stars in the sky. But as you read deeply the book of Philippians and listen to what Paul is saying, you know that Paul is not just waxing poetic. Paul believes that there is this other way of being, this other way of living possible for followers of Jesus because of the resurrection that might allow us to shine brightly in a dark world, a kind of brilliance, right? That's what we've been talking about, brilliance that's possible. And it's a brilliance that demonstrates that we are, in fact, children of God. I feel like Paul is saying there's a family resemblance that begins to happen among the family of God that can shine bright in the world. Now, I don't know what your feeling is about family resemblance, especially of the physical variety. Are you one of those people who can look at a little baby's face and say, "Oh, yes, that's her dad's chin"? I am not like that. I don't seem to be able to see what others see. I'm of the more obvious variety. My teenage son grew out his hair during COVID, and lo and behold, it's really curly, just like mine. That's the kind of family resemblance that I can recognize and own. But I've also been reflecting, as my sons are now in the later teenage years, entering that emerging adulthood phase, I've been reflecting on a different kind of family resemblance, not the physical variety, but maybe one that ends up having greater weight in the motion of our lives. The family resemblance that's linked to the things that we value, the way that we treat one another. I had this very striking experience a number of years ago where I stood back and I watched one of my sons interact so very appropriately with an older adult. I observed him to use a good amount of eye contact, to respond to questions with clarity and enough volume, even to throw out an interesting question of his own. And I thought, how do you learn to do that? Neither my husband nor I had ever taught him that, not in a like step-by-step kind of way. But I think some of what I was seeing that day was a family resemblance. Growing up in our home, in our family, he had learned how to address an older adult, how to hold his own in a respectful way in a conversation. And I think that's the kind of family resemblance that Paul is calling out of the Philippians and all who know Jesus. It's this picture that as we live connected to Jesus, we begin to become like him. As we live connected to Jesus and his resurrection power, we are changed. Now, the human experience of that change is that it's very bit by bit. It's 1% at a time more like Jesus, but it's possible and it happens. As we get up close to Jesus and his resurrection power, there are a whole host of God's aspects that can begin to shape and be seen in our lives. We've talked about a number of them through this series, and today we come to Paul's charge, this picture that we could live as people of peace in an anxious world. People of peace in an anxious world. We're coming now to the end, toward the end of Paul's letter to the Philippians. And there's a sense at this point in the letter that Paul's starting to kind of pick up speed with his encouragements to the Philippians. Like, I got to get this all out before I finish. So as I hear his words, I hear it with a, whatever else happens, you know, don't forget these things. Paul begins in this section saying, therefore, my brothers and sisters, you whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, stand firm in the Lord in this way, dear friends. I'm going to pause here for just a minute. Throughout this series, we have referenced some of the situation that the Philippians and the Philippian church in particular find themselves in. They're living under Roman occupation. So they were continually confronted with persecution and opposition. It was a pressured time. It wasn't a peaceful time. And on top of that, Paul, who was the spiritual father, the kind of senior leader of the church in Philippi, is now imprisoned in Rome. So the people of God in Philippi had every natural reason to be leaking hope. And once again here, Paul is rallying them to a different way of seeing their circumstances, to a different way based on the present resurrection power of Jesus. He calls them to stand firm. Don't give up. Don't give in. Remember the family that you belong to. And after that sort of rousing start, Paul gets really practical with them about what it could look like, how it is that they can stand firm. It goes on. I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my co-workers, whose names are in the book of life. So I told you Paul was going to get practical. I didn't foreshadow for you how personal Paul was going to get. Do you feel a little bit for Euodia and Syntyche being called out like this in the letter? It helps me to remember that these are friends. These are co-workers of Paul. He knew these women. He cared for them deeply. And most of those who received this letter had a relationship with Paul. ultimately, what I hear Paul saying, specific to their situation, but more broadly, is that it matters that we live at peace with one another. It matters to fight for that peace, that some of how the followers of Jesus are to shine as stars in the sky is as people who work to live at peace with one another. It's important enough that those around people who are experiencing tension should engage to help them live at peace. Now, there's a lot that can be said about this value and how it gets lived out, what the principles that have come to be seen as helpful around this are. We're not going to talk about that this morning. That's for another time. Because Paul goes on to talk about other aspects of peace, and those are the places where he elaborates in this section. So I am going to keep us moving in the passage. From there, Paul says this: "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice, and the God of peace will be with you." Paul offers a fair bit of practical instruction in this set of verses in his letter, and he also references tremendous promises of God, how it is that God partners with the practical instruction that Paul is giving. But I am aware, as we come to this section of Scripture, that these are verses that can have the effect, and I know have had the effect, perhaps in some of our lives, of doubling back on us when we haven't understood them fully in their context. Sometimes people can read this passage and infer that if I'm anxious and I pray and I'm still anxious, I must be doing it wrong. I should pray better, more, different. Something's wrong with me and my prayer. The problem must be me. And when you're already coming to the prayer as an anxious person, that seems like an awfully heavy weight to bear. I think the critical misstep in that understanding or that interpretation of what's going on here is that we've put the weight of the change that Paul is encouraging for us on us when it belongs on God. The promise that God pairs with the activity that Paul calls us to is what's important. Paul is not saying that the work of recovery from anxiety, rescue from anxious thoughts, rests with us. It rests with God. Paul is describing practices that we can do that open us to this power of God. There's a partnership happening here, but the weight of the partnership, let's be clear, is on God himself. So we unburden ourselves, we bring our worries to God in prayer, and that creates a space into which the peace of God comes and holds us. We do practice setting our minds on praiseworthy things, and in doing so, something somewhat mysterious happens, that there is a greater connection to the God of peace in our lives. This is the different way of being that's made possible because of the resurrection. We do our part, and the power that transforms our inner being, the real lift, comes from God, who longs and makes himself available to help us. So I'd like to break this down a little more concretely for us, go a little more slowly through this section. Paul begins by saying, "Do not be anxious about anything. If only it were that simple. It is no surprise to anyone in this room that we live in anxious times, right? Many have called it an epidemic of anxiety. Gen Z has come to be known as the anxious generation, partly because of the popular book of that name. It's a little bit like this image. It's like arrows of anxiety are coming at us from all directions much of the time. You know, just speaking for myself at the personal level, you know, I am always carrying with me my worry for my aging parents and their well-being. I am always carrying with me my concern for my emerging young adult sons. And in this season, I'm carrying with me my worry about what the future holds for me. And that's just at like the closest circle to me, right? From there, there are concentric circles of concern. People I love, people I know about, all the way out to the global stage. Not a week goes by that I don't listen to the news and feel deeply troubled. I may know enough to know that I don't understand all the complexities of what's represented there, but there are things that are deeply troubling about the situations in our world. All of these arrows of worry coming to us constantly. So Paul says, the response to those ever-present arrows of anxiety is a call to prayer. And there is a way in which prayer sort of pushes back at those arrows. Paul says, in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. There is no fancy way to do this. This is just telling God what worries us. You can do it in your most common language. You can do it in a pissy mood, frankly. God is inviting us to tell us about the things that worry us. You know, psychological research has proven to us that the naming of the things that we're afraid of is a helpful activity, that there is power in naming what we fear. It can right-size it. It can sort of objectify it. Now, when you take that and you name what you fear in the presence of God, in that space, you can encounter the reality that you are not alone in what you hold. And not only are you not alone, you're with one who comes to help, right? And that's the promise of God. Paul says, this power is the peace of God, which transcends understanding, and it will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Now, I find this particularly interesting. In this passage, at least, Paul doesn't promise that there will be a change in the things that worry you. We do believe about God that he can affect our circumstances, that God is powerful and capable to change worrying circumstances. But in this passage, Paul is saying that the circumstances may not change. What changes is this space that the peace of God creates in our innermost being where worry cannot penetrate. The worry comes at us, we push back at it by naming it in the presence of God, and a space is created that the peace of God himself protects for us. It's a space where worry and threat cannot enter. It's a peace that transcends understanding. The external circumstances may not have changed, but peace is sure in this place. I'm wondering if you have experienced that kind of creation of peace in the center of your being. In my experience, I would tell you that it is a gift. It is something that God graces us with, and it is a gift that works. It's a gift that has power and impact. It's also been my experience, and I know this sort of tweaks some of our sense maybe of what we think of when we think of a gift. But I would say it's a gift that we're helped at least to actively receive and to hold. So let me tell you a little bit about like what that looks like in my life. As most of you are aware, I'm coming into the last couple months of my tenure on the River staff. And I've shared publicly that I feel clear-minded and confirmed about that decision. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't come with a lot of questions that can feel pretty concerning to me at times. So I am learning, again, to follow Paul's admonition and to name my worries before God. So regularly in my prayer, I am talking to God about, you know, will there be meaningful work for me in my life beyond the river? Where will my family worship when we no longer worship at the river? What will community look like for us? But when I come to a reasonable place of having unloaded my list, I don't know if you're ever completely at the end of your list, but when I come toward the end of my list, I am practicing prayerful imagination. What does it look like that the peace of God is rushing into this space that has been emptied of worry to hold me in a place of peace? My experience with that is that it's, like I said, it's real. I encounter a sense of connection to the well-being that God promises, the peace that is substantial, that basically tells me, like, I will be okay. I am protected here. My experience also is that the arrows of worry continue to come, and I lose track of, I lose sight of this space, and so I have to come back to it again and again and again. It's not a one and done kind of experience of peace in the center of my being. So I practice receiving this gift. I practice holding this gift again and again, and I trust that over time, I am taking on, bit by bit, more of the character of God that is peace for myself and peace that I can shine into the world around me. There is a second aspect to this closing instruction that Paul offers to the Philippians that I want to take a look at for a minute. You'll remember from the verses that I read that Paul goes on to say, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. Right, Paul is saying in this extended list, he's like underscoring it again and again, that the thoughts that we rehearse, the place that we focus our attention, it matters. It affects our ability to experience and to be transformed by the God who is peace. I wonder what you think about that. I wonder what you think about that. I mean, my guess is that it rings true, that it's important where we put our attention, where we put our attention affects us. But I have been reflecting this week that one of the things I actually really appreciate about many people in our community is that we have learned to actually put our attention on brokenness. On the brokenness that exists in us, on the brokenness that exists in the world, and when we connect that to our hope and prayer for God to be the one who redeems all the brokenness, I think that's a really good practice. It's what makes our faith grounded. It's what makes our faith have impact on ourselves and the world around us. But I do think it's possible that when we train ourselves to be awake and aware to the brokenness, that it can eclipse the loveliness. And I hear Paul saying that it is important for us to focus our attention on any and every praiseworthy thing as well. That's a critical part of our training in resurrection. This idea that God is alive And God is revealing God's self to us in all of these experiences that we have of loveliness and admirable things and pure things and true things. I like the way that Trappist monk Thomas Merton expressed some of the reality and the tension that I think Paul is talking about. Thomas Merton said this once, "We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent, and God is shining through it all the time. This is not just a fable or a nice story. It is true. God shows himself everywhere, in everything, in people and in things and in nature and in events. The only thing is, we don't see it." That's the tension. God is shining, and we have to learn to look. That's what I hear Paul saying with strength to the listeners to his letter in Philippi. Paul says, look, anything praiseworthy that you can find, look at it. Notice it. Is there any expression of kindness or generosity around you? Notice it. Take it in. Stare for a while. Is there anything lovely or beautiful in your sight? Stop and notice. Look. Take it in. Is there anything admirable in your view? Look at it. Rehearsing praiseworthy things is a way to bring our attention and ultimately our connection closer to the God who is peace. That's an astounding promise. So in both of these ways, bringing our anxieties before God, naming, looking at the things that are praiseworthy around us, Paul is saying there's the prospect of becoming people who resemble the family of God in the peace that we live with and display in the world. You know, quite a bit has been written in the last few decades about the power of a non-anxious presence in a family or a team. I don't know if you're familiar with that particular phrase, the idea of a non-anxious presence. It comes from the reality that there's a growing understanding that anxiety actually has a strong social component. Many would say that anxiety is actually contagious. I don't know if that's a concept that you've come upon. It seems a little bit odd to me at first, but then I reflect on the way that I experience in circles that I'm a part of. When someone shows up with a great deal of tension, agitation, anxiety, it often is the case that that can have a domino effect through the circle. The interesting thing is that the same is true in reverse. One non-anxious presence, one person that's connected to the peace of God and the God of peace, demonstrating that presence in the world can begin to reverse the cascade of anxiety. That may sound like a grand image, and it is. It's a big calling, but I believe it's something that would be equivalent to shining like stars in a dark world. So I want to invite you, if you're willing this morning, to join me in a reflective prayer space as I close this message, something that centers on the words of Paul and the encouragements of Paul that we've been talking about. And it's something that you can repeat when you're alone in your prayer space as well. It's a way of rehearsing, of making ourselves available to God's activity to make us as people of peace for our own good and for the world around us. So I'm aware that you've been sitting still, listening attentively, which I very much appreciate, for a while. I'm not going to give you time and space to stand, but if you want to just shift around a little bit to sort of prepare yourself to enter a time of quiet, reflective prayer, you can stretch, just don't hit your neighbor. And then settle into a posture that helps you be both relaxed and alert Some people find that it's helpful to put both feet on the floor to feel the chair against your back. Find a posture that will help you enter a place of prayer for a few minutes. And as you find that posture, I just invite you to take a few deep breaths slowly. And we do this because we understand that connecting to our breath, letting our breath communicate with our body, really does help us to be present to the present moment, to ourselves and to the God who is always with us. Paul says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition with thanksgiving, present your requests to God." As the worries that you carry today come to your mind, tell God about them. Just list them out. Present your requests to God. The promise of God is that the peace of God, which transcends understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. And so, with the gift of your imagination, I want to invite you to the practice I described engaging in myself. Could you imagine the peace of God encircling the core of your being and pushing back the worry, creating a protected space of peace at your very core? Recognizing that not all of us are equally connected to our imagination, I just want to invite you to notice anything you can notice about what that space inside you looks like. Is there any image attached to it? Maybe you notice that it's associated with a certain color or a certain temperature. What do you notice about the space created by the peace of God within you? Thank you. Now, from that space of peace, I encourage you to take a moment and see if you could name anything true, noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable that comes to your mind. Maybe as you look back over the last week, you'd find that there are praiseworthy things. Would you let them come to mind? Notice them. Look at them. Appreciate them. Paul's final promise is that as we think on these things, the God of peace will be with us. So as the worship team comes and prepares to lead us in musical worship, I encourage you just to linger in this silent, still place for another moment, inviting God to fill your awareness with his presence. With his presence as the God of peace in your life.